It's time once again for Pop Culture Happy Hour's Summer Movie Preview.
This summer is jam-packed with huge franchises like Star Wars, The Avengers, Jurassic Park, and Ant-Man. We'll make some box office predictions about the biggest blockbusters in a little bit, but we'll also talk about what we're most excited to see, whether it's big or small. I'm Stephen Thompson.
And I'm Linda Holmes. Also joining us is Glenn Weldon of the NPR Arts Desk. Hi, Glenn.
Hey, Linda.
And with us for this traditional kickoff to the summer season is Aisha Harris, the host of Slate's Represent podcast. Hey, Aisha.
Hi, Linda.
Good to have you with us. I don't think you've been with us since we reviewed Darkest Hour.
How wonderful that was.
Yeah, this may be a little more fun and upbeat. So we want to start by talking about some of the films that we are most excited to see over the summer. And we should say, too, it's been harder and harder to define what summer is since now it seems to start.
It starts on Valentine's Day.
It starts, you know, maybe March, maybe April, arguably Valentine's Day. But we are treating it as starting essentially at the end of April-ish. Mm-hmm. So, Glenn, what are you excited to see this summer?
The Incredibles 2 comes out on June 15th. The original Incredibles from 2005 is the best superhero movie that has ever been made. Fight me. It's likely also the best superhero film to ever be made. Come at me, bro. That's a characteristic of its alchemical blending of great characters, extraordinary vocal performances. The music is key to that film. And the design. We don't talk about Lou Romano, who did the production design on that. This retro-futuristic look and feel. That's whole building out this entire world so it's consistent. The jokes are good. The story is about a midlife crisis. It's about a superhero, Mr. Incredible, going through a midlife crisis, trying to recapture old glory, which, as a story, isn't fresh, but it really leans into that whole design and that whole aesthetic it's going for, as does the politics. Politics of that first movie, a little Randian, you might say.
Sure.
For the second film, which is coming out, I say, June 15th, you can't do Mr. Incredible goes through a midlife crisis again. So what they're doing very smartly is they're focusing on Elastigirl, right? And that means that we're going to get more of Holly Hunter's marvelous voice in my ears, and that's never a bad thing.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Glenn Weldon. Aisha Harris, we're going to go to you next. What are you most excited to see this summer?
My thing that I am most excited to see this summer is Crazy Rich Asians. Mm. And it's based on a book by Kevin Kwan. The book came out about 5 years ago in 2013. And it was a big hit when it came out, and it even spawned a couple of sequels. And it centers around a bunch of characters who are of a rich and fancy lifestyle. They're sort of the socialite elite. And they include Rachel Chu, who is an economics professor in New York, as well as Nick Young, who is her boyfriend. And he takes her to Singapore to go to a wedding, and she gets to meet all the family, and hijinks ensue. And there's, as far as I know, it's all about the sort of class dynamics, about cross-cultural dynamics, all these very interesting things that are happening. Now, the reason why I'm so excited about this movie is because I think, with the exception of the Joy Luck Club, this is the first movie, at least since that movie, that has a predominantly Asian cast that is being released by a major studio and globally. So the cast is really amazing. You have Constance Wu of Fresh Off the Boat fame. She's playing Rachel Chu. You also have Henry Golding, who's playing Nick Young, the boyfriend. Now, there's been quite a bit of controversy around the movie in terms of the casting. There have been some who have criticized some of the actors who are playing these characters for not necessarily falling into the category of the characters they're playing. So you have someone like Henry Golding, who is a Eurasian actor. There are some who have said, you know, well, you're casting this actor who is Asian ostensibly, but he doesn't look full Asian, or he's like the safe choice to put on movie posters, and that's why they cast him. It'll be really interesting to see how all of this plays out, especially considering that this is a first, and we always see these things happen. Whenever you have a movie that is portraying a underserved community, there's going to be these discussions happening.
Yeah, and I think this one is going to feel a little different, I would think, partly because it does have Asian American director John Chu.
Yeah, I will say I'm also curious because John Chu, his best known credits are Step Up 2.
Yeah,
Justin Bieber, Never Say Never. So we'll see how it actually pans out. But I'm optimistic.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much, Aisha. So I am very excited about Ocean's 8, and anybody who knows me knows how much I love Ocean's 11, not the original. but the George Clooney, Brad Pitt remake, which was a Steven Soderbergh movie. And that is such an endlessly rewatchable, enjoyable, kind of genial movie.
Yeah.
So this film is a follow-up to that. Sandra Bullock is playing George Clooney's sister. Clooney's not in the movie. So Sandra Bullock is heading up kind of this team. Mindy Kaling is in it. Cate Blanchett is in it. Rihanna is in it. Awkwafina is in it. There are all these like really interesting, cool women. The plot is to rob Anne Hathaway, who seems to be playing like a version of Anne Hathaway or a version of like the public perception
right.
of Anne Hathaway at the Met Ball, which I think is brilliant. I cannot wait to see it. I'm so excited. It has to be good or I will be so bummed.
I like it. I like that pick.
Thank you very much. I'll be very sad if it's not good and very excited when it is good. Go Rihanna.
I love your options. Go
yes.
Rihanna, fresh off her performance in Valerian.
Go Rihanna.
City of what, 1,000 planets?
Yeah, and Battleship. Don't forget
and Battleship. Oh, my gosh.
And
yeah.
more importantly, thank you, Rihanna, for the great lipsticks.
Yes.
So, Stephen Thompson, what did you pick for most excited to see?
You know, I think a lot around the summer movie season about counter-programming, what will soothe my weary soul after a blockbuster after blockbuster, these kind of big, oversized, loud, 2.5-hour action movies. And I found one that is not only counter-programming against that, but against everything that is unpleasant in the world.
It's true.
When I went to see Isle of Dogs, they ran the trailer for Won't You Be My Neighbor?
Mm-hmm.
The documentary about Mr. Rogers.
And Stephen, when I saw this on the Google Doc as your pick, I was like, yep, makes sense.
Story checks out.
You just want to cry. That's all.
I watched this trailer, and I was like not just tearing up.
Yeah, see?
I was like tears streaming down my face. First of all, it is a very effective trailer if you have not seen it. Enormously heavy touch with the music, but the material seemed to really support it. You know, Glenn, we've talked about superhero movies, and you talk about your love of superheroes. And one thing that you look for is the idea that the world needs someone to believe in, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like that's part of the appeal is like you love Superman. You love an absolute good. And I like the idea that in 2018, the superhero we can all connect with and agree on is a Presbyterian minister and kids show host who died in 2003.
Yep.
Yeah.
But
I thought it was Oprah.
The trailer, you know, which has tons and tons and tons of footage, it's clearly working with not only Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, but a lot of like home movies and TV interviews and stuff, seems to just have the right touch. The director is Morgan Neville, who won an Oscar for 20 Feet from Stardom.
Oh, that's a great movie, too.
So mm-hmm. So there you go. You know, you're getting a sense that this particular figure is in great hands, and it just feels the mix of nostalgia and hope and kindness just feels like medicine right now. So
yeah.
That one, whether it were a summer movie or an any time of the year movie, I would be looking enormously forward to it.
Oh, that's such a good pick.
Thank you.
Although I'm so sad now.
Yeah. Yep.
Okay, so we have now talked about all of the things that we are excited to see. We are going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about box office. We're going to talk about hard, brutal numbers, what we think is going to make the most money, and what we think is going to be the biggest boondoggle. So we'll be back with that in just a minute.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Fully. Fully's standing desks and collection of active sitting chairs give you the freedom to sit, stand, stretch, or lean into positions designed to keep you more engaged in your work. From product selection, delivery to customer service, Fully has your back every step of the way. To set up your active workspace, go to fully.com/happyhour. Fully, desks, chairs, and things to keep you moving.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. We are in the middle of our summer movie preview. We've already talked about what we're excited about, and now we're getting down to business. And by business, I mean money. We are going to talk a little bit about predictions for what we think is going to make the most money. That's our next topic. Now, we are bad at this.
Yes.
I just want to say, we're historically, we're not good at this.
No.
So we are going to begin with Glenn. And Glenn is going to tell us what he thinks is going to make the most money this summer.
Yes, and we did not share our picks with each other.
No, I didn't.
So we
pulled an order out of a hat.
Yeah, some kind of seating thing I don't quite understand, which always leaves me boned. But Jurassic World, it's going to be Jurassic World, right? It's got to be. This franchise is my pop culture blind spot. I don't get it. I don't like dinosaurs. I don't understand why people keep going to these movies. I don't know why people in the world of the movie keep going back to this park. So every time there's one of these movies, there's all this sweaty explanation. Well, now the gates are much higher. Like, I don't know. It's just stupid.
And don't go to the place where the dinosaurs are. That would be my tourism tip.
It's a commentary on humanity's inability to learn.
I imagine that all the tourists who come to this park have been to the restaurant where they got food poisoned like 5 times. And every time they get food poisoning, they're like, maybe next time.
But the thing is, tourists won't even go to a place where they think the trains are too crowded.
Exactly.
And yet somehow they're like, sure, of course, dinosaur park. Yeah. They probably won't eat us this time.
Yeah.
I bet they've got it all figured out. Go ahead.
I never understand. Anyway, but millions and millions of people are not me. And they will go to see this thing. So Jurassic World, a few years back, made $1.7 billion.
Hated it.
That's billion with a B. It was the number two film of that year. It was up against Force Awakens. It is the number fourth most successful film in terms of box office of all time.
Hated it.
I did too. So if we're going to compare Jurassic World to Avengers, just we have Avengers and Jurassic World going head-to-head this summer. If we look at it, so Jurassic World, 1.7, Avengers Age of Ultron, 1.5. So I think even if you include the Avengers film, which I'm sure one of you guessed, I don't know, and you allow the fact that it's going to be in theaters much longer, I still think people want to see dinosaurs eat folk for reasons that mystify me. So
interesting.
Jurassic World 2.
Interesting.
Lost Kingdom.
I am the next to pick, as it happens, and I'm going to pick Avengers, Infinity War. And I'll tell you why. You know why? You know why? Because I believe in people. I believe in people. People went to see Jurassic World. I mean, I went to see Jurassic World, but I know it was bad. And my theory is enough people have now learned everything there was to learn from Jurassic World, including mean women have bobs.
Mean women
have straight, blunt haircuts, blunt bobs. That's basically the only thing I learned. And it is possible to make Chris Pratt not charming, which for many years I did not believe that was possible. Yeah. Now, it will still make a ridiculous amount of money to me based on the fact that, I don't know if I've mentioned this, but I hated the first one.
Mm-hmm.
However, I think Avengers Infinity War, particularly coming so close off of Black Panther and the fact that some of the Black Panther cast is in it, the people who love Black Panther will go to see anything with Black Panther in it, right?
Like me.
Exactly. Fans of Black Panther are super into Black Panther right now because it just came out.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you're going to get a gigantic push of Black Panther fans on top of the regular Avengers fans. I think that there will be additional audience. I think that's going to build on itself. It's like if Jurassic World had added something more interesting for the second film in the franchise, which it hasn't.
Okay.
By the logic that says everyone who loves Black Panther will go see Infinity War, by that logic, everyone who's ever seen a movie ever will go to this movie because this movie has everyone and everything in it fighting for attention.
Exactly.
It feels like the degree to which these movies are punishing in their extreme amount of stuff is kind of hinted at in the title. I feel like the next one will be called, like, The Avengers Punishing Onslaught.
Okay, but the best part of Civil War was the big fight that everyone was in.
Yeah,
that was the best
true.
Part of Civil
that's
War.
True.
Like, when Spider-Man all of a sudden up showed up and you were like, Spider-Man 2, hi! Like, that was the best part. Wait, I want to ask, do you agree with me, Aisha, about Avengers?
Oh, for sure. In fact, had I gotten first pick, I would have chosen Avengers for that very reason, because I fall directly into that demographic of people who saw Black Panther without having ever seen any of the Avengers movies. Like, I don't care about the Avengers, period. But now that I know a few of the Black Panther characters are going to be in it, I have already bought my ticket to go see this new Avengers, and I know I'm going to be sorely disappointed because Black Panther and Shuri and all the other folks will probably be in there for like two minutes.
I think everybody's going to be in there for a scene and a half. It's only got so
but
many scenes.
Whatever.
All right, Aisha, what do you think is going to make the most money?
Well, since I got third pick and I'm probably going to lose this, I'm going with a movie we've actually already discussed, which is Incredibles 2.
Mm-hmm. Nice. That's a good pick.
Yeah. So my thinking here is that there's a couple of things. First of all, this movie has been highly anticipated for going on 14 years now. And the fact that this is like the one superhero movie ever created that doesn't have a sequel is kind of ridiculous. So I think that having that, having Brad Bird back, it's all building up this intense anticipation for this movie and hopefully not a letdown. I think also we've seen previous Pixar movie sequels do very, very well. Mm-hmm. In fact, Finding Dory, which no one was asking for. I don't think anyone was really
asking
for.
That's one we missed on our summer preview that time.
It still made $1 billion worldwide on a $200 million budget. So I feel like Incredibles can surpass that, maybe. I think that even though it is a very crowded field, I think that that'll kind of channel into the kid sector of the summer movie blanket here. And I also think that we can look at the fact that when the first teaser premiered back in the fall, it actually broke a record, at least according to Entertainment Weekly, it broke a record for the biggest trailer debut for an animated film ever. And it garnered something like 113 million views. So I think anticipation is high. Incredibles 2 is my best choice as the number three seed here. Uh-huh. And I'm just going to say that it's going to make over $1 billion.
I think that's a good bet. I think that's a good bet. And I think, honestly, the pick that you had, where you were in the draft, this is a great pick.
Yep.
Thank you.
I think this is a great pick. All right. Stephen Thompson, you are last up with Make the Most Money. I know, right? It's all the good ones are taken.
Well, I don't know. I feel like it's a choice at this point between two major franchises. Solo, A Star Wars Story. Mm-hmm. He's got this. I mean, those Star Wars movies make a bloody fortune. I'm not sure the buzz on this one is as strong. And the one that I picked, given that I had fourth pick, I went ahead with Deadpool 2.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I get that. Mm-hmm.
Now, the first Deadpool's budget was $58 million. Globally, it made $783 million. Mm-hmm. I don't know what the exact budget is on Deadpool 2, but they seem to have taken the lesson that they don't have to bloat out the sequel. They don't have to suddenly spend $200 million on it. They can keep it kind of lean and dirty, as it were, and make a kind of combination superhero action movie and wacky comedy. And they've marketed this thing very, very heavily as both, and have been marketing it very heavily as both for a while. It's going to be a different director. It's David Leitch, who did John Wick and Atomic Blonde. Mm-hmm. I feel like you're going to have a mix of just kind of, I use the word onslaught when talking about the Avengers, kind of just an onslaught of gags and goofnuttery.
Well, those are both, when you talk about John Wick and Atomic Blonde, those are both very stylish action movies. They're both very, in their own way, really kind of cool. What am I looking
for? Well,
they're
both movies you would describe using the word kinetic.
Yeah. Sure.
Yes, I think that's right.
But they're also both, like Deadpool, R-rated.
Yeah.
Sure. Which mm-hmm. is going to depress tickets a little bit.
$783 million.
It's still not going to attain the heights of the top three.
Well, I was picking four.
Well, there it is.
It's a recurring theme.
Okay, we're gonna move on to my personal sentimental favorite category, which is biggest boondoggle. Now, we've gone back and forth about what exactly this means. Does it mean, you know, money compared to budget? Does it mean, you know, what exactly are we talking about when we say boondoggle? And I think we have to eventually admit that we're just talking about what comes out with the reputation of being the giant failure flop, because it has something to do with expectations. It has something to do with investment. It has something to do with budget, which when you include marketing and things can be very hard to actually nail down. We're just looking for, like, what's the flop? What do you see as the potential flop? So this one, Aisha, you get the first pick.
Yes, I made my pick based very much more heavily on budget / anticipation to what it will actually make. And so my pick, which is probably going to be very controversial, I don't know, but I think that the biggest boondoggle is going to be Solo, A Star Wars Story.
Oh, interesting.
Okay.
Yes, see? It's
no,
it's not
I mean,
exactly.
No,
I think that's a, I want to hear more.
Yeah.
Okay, so I think that when you think about the way this movie has been set up and the fact that when it was first announced and when it was originally conceived and put into casting and all that stuff, they had the directors, Phil Lord and Chris Miller, who are best known for the Lego movie. And I think a lot of people were kind of excited slash curious about that sort of pairing within the Star Wars world, because they are very comedic, meta-heavy, all that fun stuff, and it'd be interesting to see how that applies to the Star Wars franchise. And of course, as we all know, last June, it was announced that they were being removed from the movie because of various things, namely that they didn't really, their creative juices did not flow with what Kathleen Kennedy of Lucasfilm and the other creators wanted to see for the movie. And so seeing them get taken off the movie after they had been shooting for a few months at that point signaled to me that there are clearly some issues. Now, obviously, there are often issues behind any Star Wars movie. That's like nothing new. But when you're taking a director or two directors off a movie and then putting a new one on to basically reshoot much of the movie, that's going to be a lot of money that you're throwing at this movie.
Yeah.
And so when you're throwing so much money in that direction, I think that that's automatically going to make whatever return on the investment for this movie that is already not that highly anticipated.
Yeah.
In fact, I was Googling, and I mean, granted, obviously, this is cherry picking. These things happen all the time, and a lot of these pieces will sometimes blow up, like one or two Twitter people saying something bad about it.
Yeah.
But there's a piece on Vulture where they were singling out some folks who seem to actually actively want Star Wars, or the Han Solo movie, to fail. And I don't know how, if that's true or not, if that's a big contingent of the Star Wars franchise. But it does seem like anticipation for this movie is very, very low compared to even something like Rogue One. Mm-hmm. And I think there's prequel fatigue, generally.
Yeah.
Alden Ehrenreich, nothing in the trailer suggests that he's going to be particularly exciting to watch. Now, maybe when we see him on screen, that'll be different. But in general, Donald Glover is not going to be able to save this movie. The Ron Howard, I'm not sure, is going to be able to save the movie. And I think this will depend a lot on word of mouth more than anything else. And I'm not entirely sure that's going to happen.
It'll be interesting to see how it turns out. All right. Thank you, Aisha, for that pick. My boondoggle pick, I decided to go with Mamma Mia 2.
That was my pick.
I had a Twitter poll the other day whether it should be called Morma Mia or Mamma Mora. And a guy on Twitter by the name of Austin Burns, I have to credit for the best solution, which is he wrote back to me and said, it should just be called Mamma Mia 2 Electric Waterloo, which is genius,
yeah,
really
kind of
super genius. I was like, poll over, whole thing done. Anyway.
But then they went with.
Here we go again, right?
Yeah, which obviously is in the song.
Sure.
But as a sequel name, here we go again.
Yeah,
it's not ideal.
So if you saw Mamma Mia, it had Amanda Seyfried as the daughter of Meryl Streep, who had her suitors, Colin Firth and Pierce Brosnan and Stellan Skarsgård. And, you know, it was sort of the who's the father and, you know, like Mamma Mia, the thing. Anyway, now it apparently doesn't have Meryl Streep in it. They're going back in time to do the story of the Meryl Streep character when she was young with these three guys to see how she got herself into this crazy mess with the three guys. Why would I not want to have Christine Baranski? I mean, I think those characters are in it, but it seems like maybe they're not the center of it.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, I'm not 100% sure that people wanted more of this without Meryl Streep.
Mm-hmm.
Aren't some people suggesting that maybe Meryl Streep's character has died in the movie?
Yeah, I believe she has.
Okay.
Her mother, it appears, is being played by Cher.
Sure.
On the one hand, when you see Cher, it's like, all right, sure, in this kind of, you know, blown out sort of thing. But at the same time, Cher doesn't look old enough to have been Meryl Streep's mother.
How many points on the back end? How much money did they throw at Cher to say, you are Meryl Streep's mother?
I honestly don't know. So that's my boondoggle pick.
But
Mamma Mora, Electric Waterloo.
Let's talk about the first one, right? It looked great. It was a poop show. The cast was having a ball.
Pierce Brosnan cannot sing.
Cannot sing. And they had that music mangled in the Pierce Brosnan sense that it was. How many of the 19 songs on ABBA Gold, their best of album, did not make it in to the first film?
None.
It's a good guess. Three is the answer.
Three.
Just
that
three.
That is pretty close to three.
So yeah. There's only three remaining.
That leaves Knowing Me, Knowing You, Fernando, and One of Us, which are solid songs, but
can't
not,
build a movie around Fernando.
Can't build a movie around Fernando.
No.
And so they're going to have to, you know, go back and dredge up all these other songs to fill it out, just like they do at the live jukebox musicals.
Yeah. Well, so that is my pick. Boondoggle, Mama Mia, Mora. Electric.
Here we go again.
Here we go again. All right, so that's mine. Stephen Thompson, what are you picking for your boondoggle?
Man, most years I have a really easy time with this. There are always a few, like, big, fat, $200 million swings at something like Valerian, which we mentioned before. I really, really struggled to find a big budget movie. So I just went with a movie that looks fishy to me. And I went, it's not a big budget movie, but I went with Gotti.
Oh, okay.
Oh, okay.
Starring John Travolta.
John Travolta. Yeah.
As the Dapper Don himself, John Gotti, and Kelly Preston as his wife, and Ella Blue Travolta as their daughter.
Mm. I sense a pattern.
I sense a vanity project.
Yeah. You're right.
And
one
when,
might.
And when you factor in the fact that it got moved from December to June, there was a whole bunch of mishigas with changing studios. It feels like a vanity project gone wrong. And it's weird to say, like, it's getting buried in the summer, but it just doesn't feel like a fit to me. It just feels, part of it is just, I mean, John Travolta can be a very, very good actor, make no mistake, but I just don't feel John Travolta as John Gotti.
I don't know how great he's been lately.
Yeah.
Like, he was good in the OJ thing, but, like, that was a very specific set of skills.
That was mostly his eyebrows.
His eyebrows did a lot of work.
A lot of that was the makeup.
I mean, the thing is, the most expensive non-sequel, non-franchise movie of the summer is Skyscraper.
According to what you were able to find.
According to what I was able to find. And that is Dwayne The Rock Johnson fighting a giant skyscraper fire.
To save Neve Campbell from Party of Five.
To save Neve Campbell from Party of Five. I can't pick that as a boondoggle. That's going to be awesome.
Dwayne The Rock Johnson.
You know, I mean, the Gotti thing, it doesn't feel like a movie. When you said that, I was like, that's not a TV thing.
That sounds like a
multi... Night Stars event? I mean, because that's...
Not Stars, like Reels.
Yeah, Reels. Exactly. Something with a Z.
All right, Glenn Weldon, pick me a boondoggle, my friend.
All right, slot in my grumbling about being last to be able to pick here, but I had to go, denied Mamma Mia. I went with Christopher Robin.
I thought about this one too.
Now, again, this is not going to be a budget thing. I don't know how much this film is budgeted, but everything about it, if I were to tell you that a grown Christopher Robin has to get in touch again with the magic and the whimsy and the imagination of his childhood, would you predict that this film would include lines like these?
We've called an emergency meeting this weekend. I promised my wife and daughter I'd take them away this weekend, sir. We need to cut 20%. You were promised these people good jobs. And I thought you'd do anything for this company.
I thought you'd do anything with this company.
This is like a British Hallmark movie.
It totally is.
Is there a scene in which Christopher Robin hurls his cell phone into a river?
Well, it's set at the time when the actual Christopher Robin would be. So it's a period piece. Hayley Atwell plays his wife. I mean, good people. Ewan McGregor. We just heard Mark Gatiss as his, I thought you loved this company, kind of boss. There is apparently some animated parts, because in the trailer we see him meet Winnie the Pooh.
And the poster suggests.
So you get Chris O'Dowd as Tigger. Good pick. You got Toby Jones as Owl. Peter Capaldi as Rabbit. It's got good things going for it, but I just think you got to be awfully ambitious if you want to flood a crowded market, a market already crowded with whimsical British stuffed bear content. I don't think there's room for it. Now, granted,
what is the other content?
Paddington 1 Paddington 2. Now, granted, a lot fewer Americans know Paddington or New Paddington than know Winnie the Pooh, but still, the thing that makes the Paddington films work is they're carried along by this really ingeniously engineered series of slapstick set pieces. It's got a very, very British baseline quirkiness. And also, in the case of Paddington 2, you have a really killer performance from Hugh Grant, just knocking it out of the park. What you have here is much more somber and treacly and saccharine and stately. So I think this is going to just blow up.
You just feel like you got enough bears to last you the rest of your life.
Yep.
All right, well, that does it for our summer movie preview. Come and find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or tweet us at PCHH and tell us what you are looking forward to and tell us how wrong we are about what will and what will not make money. Now, when we come back, it is going to be time for us to talk about our favorite topic, what is making us happy this week. So come right back.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Stonyfield Organic Kids. If you like organic stuff and your kids like yummy stuff, Stonyfield makes it easy. With a whole bunch of organic yogurt treats, like convenient cups, pouches, smoothies, and tubes, they're always ready to go. Best of all, Stonyfield is made without the use of toxic persistent pesticides, artificial hormones, antibiotics, or GMOs. If you're ready for yum, visit stonyfield.com/NPR.
This is Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We do long-form interviews with the people behind the best books, pop culture, journalism, and more, so you can get to know the people whose work you love. You'll find Fresh Air on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. It is time for our favorite segment of this week and every week. What is making us happy this week? Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week, buddy?
Well, last week you may have heard that Taylor Swift recorded a cover of Earth, Wind & Fire's September. It was not well received. Mm-hmm. It is not what's making me happy this week. Mm-hmm. What is making me happy this week is that there was another cover that dropped right around the same time from what I found to be a very unexpected source, namely The Temptations. Just my imagination. Papa was a Rolling Stone. The Temptations. Been around for a million years, a million lineup changes.
Well, yeah, I was just going to say, I believe there's been some turnover.
A little bit of lineup changes over the last 80 years or whatever. First Temptations album in 8 years is coming out. It's called All the Time. And I would think, meh, new Temptations, you know, good for them. Cash that check, make that money. They have a cover of the song Earned It by The Weeknd. You want a falsetto? The Temptations got a falsetto for you.
That's right. That's a nice slow love jam right there.
It's got me interested in a Temptations album that comes out in 2018, mm-hmm. which is a feat in and of itself. So The Temptations covering The Weeknd's song Earned It from a forthcoming album called All the Time.
Thank you very much, Stephen Thompson. All right, Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
Killing Eve is a new BBC America series, premiered on April 8th. It's got an 8-episode season, so I am watching it along with y'all. I don't have screeners. Mm-hmm. I am 2 episodes in as we tape this. It's so good. Developed and written, the episodes are written by Phoebe Waller-Bridge of Fleabag, who we've talked about on the show many times, based on novels by Luke Jennings. Stars Sandra Oh, with whom I was not familiar, as I'm not a Grey's watcher. I knew her from Sideways. It turns out she's great. Newsflash. Sandra Oh is really, really great. She plays a desk officer at a British intelligence organization who becomes obsessed with capturing this international assassin played by Jodie Comer. It is smart. It is funny. It is tense. It is knowing about its tropes. When we first are introduced to the Sandra Oh character, they do it in a way that is engineered to make you trigger, I know what's up with this woman. I know what's up with this character. I therefore know where this series is going. She obviously had some trauma in her past, and so now we're going to watch. Nope. Within 20 seconds of doing it, they just go, nope, out the door. It is so smart and so good. Killing Eve on BBC America.
Thank you very much, Glenn Weldon. Killing Eve on BBC America. Aisha Harris, what is making you happy this week?
I am still recovering from Beyonce.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
At Coachella. Still recovering. I was unfortunately not there, but I don't have money like that to go drop and hang out on the desert for however many days the Coachella Festival happens. Nor do I like large crowds like that and having to be around them for that long. But I'm so grateful that they live streamed it and that the rest of the world, the masses, were able to see it. I honestly feel like maybe I'm being hyperbolic here, but I feel like to some extent it is, there is no precedent for Beyonce and how much she continues to just keep getting better and better this late in her career and still stay relevant. Obviously, there have been other artists before her who, you know, still turned out great performances in their later careers still.
She's 36.
Yeah, but she's been around for 20 years
now.
It's Destiny Child's first album came out in 97, I think.
Oh,
so she's
right.
been around for 20 years.
It's true.
So yes, I know she's young. And look, Michael, who we all compare her to, Michael Jackson, he started at 9. By the time he was 30, he put out Bad. So that was late career Michael, mid-career Michael. Anyway, I think it's unprecedented to see someone like her just keep getting better. And the fact that she brought out an HBCU marching band and the dancers, and no one cares about Jay-Z, but he showed up, and Destiny Child was there. Solange was there. She sang the Negro National Anthem, Lift Every Voice and Sing. She even interpolated everything from Back That Ass Up to Nina Simone to a little bit of the Jacksons. And it had literally everything you would want from Beyonce and then some. And she did that thing for 2 hours. I'm still recovering. It's going to go in the history books as one of the best performances, live performances ever. And the fact that she did it all while almost having a wardrobe malfunction and handling it all with grace. There's a moment where her strap was, she kept looking at her, oh, what's going to happen? But she kept on singing those songs. Uh-huh. She kept on dancing. She kept on moving. It did not hinder her. And so she's still, to me, one of the most consummate performers that we have today. Hands down.
Absolutely.
I noticed Twitter seemed to like that show.
Thank you very much, Aisha Harris. Making me happy this week, a rare for me, venturing into high, high literature. I had the opportunity to present a literary prize last week for Aspen Words, which is part of the Aspen Institute, if you follow their Ideas Festival and all that stuff. The award went to Mohsen Hamid's Exit West, but I also, in preparing for this, finally read Jessamyn Ward's Sing, Unburied, Sing. Mm-hmm. This book, if you try to write and you read this book, it's one of those books that on the one hand will make you just love writing more than anything, and also will make you be like, well, there's no point in me writing anything. I am a fraud. It really is one of those books where it is so beautifully written from a variety of points of view. It incorporates sort of ghosts, and it's very, very delicate, but it's incredibly confident that you will stay with it, that you will understand where she's going, even as she switches perspectives and even as very unexpected things happen. I had a really wonderful time reading it. When the book wins a lot of awards, you start to feel like that reading the book will be work. And there's nothing wrong with reading a book that is work, but this is a book that's incredibly pleasurable just in terms of the sentence-to-sentence writing. It's incredibly beautiful. It's so moving. I highly, highly recommend it. Not that anybody needs this recommendation from me if they like books, but Sing, Unburied, Sing by Jessamyn Ward. So that is what's making me happy this week. Before we go, we want to take a minute to recognize Carl Castle, a very important part of the NPR family, to say the least, who died on Tuesday. He had been with NPR from 1975 until he retired in 2014. Hoo boy.
Yeah.
That's a long time. You might know him as one of our longtime newscasters, but you probably also know him as the scorekeeper and the sidekick of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me with Peter Sagal, which he presided over from 1998 until he retired. So we just want to say a little bit about Carl and his place here at NPR. What do you want to say, Stephen?
Well, first of all, I think, anyone in this room in general owes a great debt to Carl, and anybody who has been able to mix the kind of traditional NPR voice with a sense of joy and a mm-hmm. sense of whimsy, I feel like I owe him a great debt in part for that. Steve Inskeep on Twitter had a great comment where he looked at Carl's Wikipedia page, and it was broken down into two categories, early career and Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. and he was marveling at how early career summarized everything leading mm-hmm. up to his spot on this game show. And first of all, this is a towering career. And second of all, that our lives aren't automatically over because we've reached a certain age.
Mm-hmm.
We talk about this all the time, this idea that we peak in our teens or our 20s or our 30s or whatever. We can peak whenever life sorts itself out that way.
He found a whole new thing at a point when a lot of people would have been retiring.
Right. Yeah. And I think it's just such a reminder that we all have so much to give and so much to offer. And I think that you know, he had such a wonderful career and such a wonderful presence. I cannot tell you the pall that was cast over this building when we got news that he had died. He was so beloved here.
Yeah. And I have to say, one of those people about whom I don't think I've ever heard an unkind word. Yeah. And that's across a lot of different projects. That's people who knew him in the newsroom. That's people who knew him at Wait Wait. It's people who knew him from contributing to kind of side projects for which he was very, very game. If you watch the OK Go video that they did when they moved the tiny desk from the old NPR building to the new one, there's this wonderful moment where the band, which is singing its way essentially over to the new building, is in the elevator coming up. And they run into Carl, and he's sort of playing old curmudgeon man.
Yep.
And they stop singing. And it's so funny. And it's not how he was at all.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But he's playing that role. And he was so game and did so many things like that. You can find things like that all over his career at NPR. So I appreciate that, too. I think he also was a great role model for anybody who just wants to be kind of up for whatever you want him to do.
Yeah, but also he was seminal to the DNA of Wait Wait. I mean, that show has a very difficult needle to thread, and he was there from the jump helping them thread that needle. It lent the show this kind of fallen gravitas, you know, this kind of, there was once something august and austere, and now it's this. And that's exactly what he brought to that show, and that's what Bill Curtis is bringing now. But, I mean, he established the mold.
Yeah. Thanks so much to Carl for all of his contributions. Best to his family and to his Wait Wait family and to the rest of his NPR family. Thank you so much to Carl Castle. So that brings us to the end of our show. You can find all of us on Twitter. You can find me at Linda Holmes. You can find Stephen at I Dislike Stephen. You can find Glenn at G.H. Weldon and Aisha at Crafting My Style. You can follow our producer, Jessica Reedy at Jessica_Reedy, and our producer emeritus and music director, Mike Katziff at Mike Katziff. That's K-A-T-Z-I-F. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in and out music, which you're tapping your foot to right now. So thanks to all of you guys for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And we will see you all back here next week.